Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte's tent city of homeless people is ordered to close today, Friday, at 5 p.m., and the impact is rippling through city and county government. COVID-19 hospitalizations are on the decline, but the waiting list for vaccinations is growing. Teachers are among those on that list. Schooling returns to the classroom. For some, we get an update on how it went, even as the legislature passes a bill mandating a complete return now. And this fall's city elections for council and mayor, including a possible vote on a new transit plan, may be delayed by a year due to census snafus. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's political correspondent, Steve Harrison. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. Glenn Berkins is also here. He is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Annie Ma is the Charlotte Observer's education reporter. She joins us as well. Good morning.
Morning.
And Nick Oxner is executive producer for investigations and the chief investigative reporter at WBTV. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So this summer, the tent city began developing on property near 12th Street between College and North Tryon. Property owners and the city and county officials have been debating for months now about what to do. And on Tuesday, County Health Director Gibby Harris stepped into the middle of it.
This is not a situation that anybody should be living in. It's not safe. The concerns of diseases from rats, especially if we're seeing dead carcasses on the property that no one is picking up and throwing away, the possibility of disease spread goes up tremendously. But the second issue is for the broader community and the opportunity for these rats, these rodents, to migrate into other parts of the community, as well as any of the potential air quality issues with the burning that's happening on the site.
And with that, she gave residents of the tent city 72 hours until 5 p.m. today to vacate.
It was determined that this was an immediate threat that needed to be addressed right away.
Rats and trash don't just accumulate overnight. What triggered this sudden, and to most people, as I understand it, surprising decision? This came as a surprise. Who wants to take that?
Everyone said it came as a surprise, mostly because if you believe everyone who's not the county, county officials made this decision to issue this order without consulting with anyone else in local government, CMPD, the city of Charlotte. Now, of course, Gibby Harris, the health director, and Dina DiOrio, the county manager, have said, look, this has become a, as you just heard, this has become a health hazard. The conditions continue to deteriorate, and we needed to take some immediate action. And yeah. I think it's the surprise part there has been in the communication or lack thereof. And that's where the breakdown is.
Gibby Harris added that if she had had her way, she would have only given them 24 hours to vacate. Your colleague, David Hodges at BTV, spoke to a resident about the rats, and he told David that they were, quote, just small mice. How bad is this rat problem?
It's difficult to tell. I went down there as well and talked with someone who described them as mice as well, but he did not deny that there was a rodent problem in the encampment. There's also unauthorized cooking fires that created kind of a thick, smoky pall that hung over the air down there. It actually reminded me of some of the refugee camps I covered when I was a foreign correspondent with the cooking fires and just the unsanitary conditions. It was not a situation that we would hope would exist in Charlotte in 2021.
That comparison to refugee camps, Glenn, that's a damning thing to say about something that's occurring not just in the United States, but in Charlotte.
Absolutely. And that is not hyperbole. I've covered a number of refugee issues, and that's really what we had there on a much smaller scale. We had people who had no sanitary conditions, who were cooking outside on cooking fires. who were living in conditions that no one in Charlotte should be living in.
Which is what Gibby essentially said. The order is officially known as an abatement of imminent hazard order, and it has people scrambling to figure out what happens next, because we did a program on this earlier this week, the day after she made this announcement, with non-governmental organizations who would have to deal with this, and this came as a complete surprise to them. They have until 5 p.m. today to figure out what's going to happen to these folks and where they go, have what decisions have been made. Who knows the answer to that?
I think they're going to, many of them are going to a hotel. They will get rooms in hotels. I think others will be put up in shelters. I think so far about 180 people have agreed to leave the encampment. And that process, I believe, has started already.
Yeah. Everyone was offered an opportunity to go to the hotel or a shelter. It's worth noting that hotel stay, they've said, is good for up to 90 days, and the county says they're going to try to work with these folks to get them more permanent housing. And I think by any measure, the conditions Glenn described, a hotel is an improvement from there. But the question is, what's going to happen 90 days from now? And I think that's what we obviously don't have the answer to yet. And hopefully, though, this is the start of some long-term addressing of the homeless problem in Charlotte.
I think it's important to remember that the solution to people who are homeless is not putting them in shelters. The long-term solution is to find them housing, and that ties us into these bigger questions of, is there permanent affordable housing in Charlotte?
Glenn.
The other thing that it's important to note is that this is not a Charlotte problem. This is a national problem. If you go to just about any major city now, from California to the DC area to wherever, you are seeing or you can find a growing number of homeless encampments where people are choosing to set up tent cities, for lack of a better phrase. So this is not just a Charlotte problem. It's an issue that we have not dealt with as a nation. And there are lots of reasons for that.
But in Charlotte, we have been taking stabs at dealing with it. We've had those, I think, two or three bond referenda on finding affordable housing or putting money forward for affordable housing. The county says they have spent $34 million in just the last year to help homeless residents during the pandemic. And since 2018, the city has kicked in $36 million. The number of shelter beds that are available in Charlotte this year has gone up. The homeless population, the influx, as I understand it, of homeless people coming to Charlotte or in Charlotte has not necessarily gone up. So why do we have a tent city? If there are beds for them, why do we have this tent city?
Well, I think it's important to remember that, you know, one thing that my colleague Lauren Lindstrom has reported on and talks about a lot is that the level of investment you need for people who are chronically homeless is so much higher than someone who might have just missed one rent payment and got evicted. And the city just needs to really invest deep amounts of money for people who need help on multiple fronts, like behavioral health and addiction. And it's also important to remember that if you're building affordable housing at 80% of the annual median income, it doesn't really help people who are in extremely difficult financial positions. And you need to be looking at lowest income housing at like 30% and below for annual median income.
Glenn.
I think Annie hit on it. This is not just a housing, affordable housing issue. Affordable housing is a big part of it. But if you spend time talking with the people in these encampments, you quickly realize that there is a lot more going on. This is a mental health issue. And we've, as a nation, we've not dealt with that. These are substance abuse issues. These issues go much deeper than just affordable housing.
And these are people who have been locked out of housing and locked out of jobs, in some cases because they have a criminal record, and sometimes the crimes are really petty crimes, but they can't get a job. And the other part of this equation is a lot of these people are working people and they can't afford housing. So that is an argument for raising the minimum wage. At one point, there didn't seem to be a lot of clarity in this about what happens to residents of this North End encampment if they refuse to leave at 5 o'clock this afternoon. CMPD, according to a statement from the city, is working with community and advocacy groups to identify other resources. Some of those resources have been identified, but they don't intend to arrest people, they say. County Manager Dina DiIorio expressed her frustration with that and with the Mecklenburg County Sheriff for refusing, that's her word, to provide enforcement. In fact, Sheriff Gary McFadden told Queen City Nerve yesterday there has been no conversation or meetings with county leaders about whether his office would be involved in this situation. Has any of this been cleared up? I mean, in the absence of enforcement, will they leave?
I mean, I think that the impression I get is that, and I haven't been on the ground covering it, but the vast majority or most of the people I think in Tent City are going to leave. I think that the county estimated 150 people were there. They've got 180 people requests to go to the housing, and the county said, okay, we will accommodate you. There probably will be some people who hang on, and like you said, CMPD does not want to be in the business of removing those people. They do not want those optics. They don't think it's their job, which is understandable. But it may be we'll see. We'll see this afternoon how many people are left. May not be many.
They don't want to, CMPD does not want to criminalize homelessness, I think was the word that they used. The number of people in that camp, it seems to me, has been growing. The first number I heard earlier in the week was around 90 to 140. Now suddenly it's grown to 200. And in fact, it may have grown because at that news conference that Dina DiIorio held earlier this week, she said the growing number could be the result of people coming into the camp because they'd heard about county efforts to relocate residents there and to take advantage of that relocation. Could that be true? They're coming in because they know they're going to get a hotel room?
Well, it could be, but if that's the only way for you to get a warm place to sleep tonight, you deserve all the assistance that we can provide you.
And so I've always thought those numbers were a little on the low side as well, based on what I've seen. And the other thing to note is that particular place is not the only place in our city where you have people living in tents. It was certainly the largest, but if you drive around the city, you will see other places where people are camped out.
So there came a question about how they were going to move these people, and that also has turned into kind of a little mess. At a news conference, County Manager Dina DiIorio alleged that Charlotte City Manager Marcus Jones didn't follow through on an offer of buses to move people from the encampments to hotels and shelters.
He said, "What do you need from me?" And I said, "I need transportation from the encampment site to the hotel." And he said, "Done." And it wasn't until yesterday that I found out from, I guess I was talking to Gibby, and Gibby said, well, they gave us the buses, but they didn't give us any bus drivers. And so when I finally was able to talk to the city manager yesterday, he said, well, we never expected you to provide bus drivers, but we're going to have the fire department do it. And then last night it got pretty sideways when the fire chief was demanding security on the buses, but it couldn't be CMPD and it couldn't be the sheriff. It had to be CAT security.
So I have 30 seconds. Why the misunderstanding over this?
That is a great question, but let's just use those 30 seconds, Mike, to underscore how extraordinary it is to see the county manager taking shots at the city manager like that. And if they're taking shots over getting bus drivers to take homeless people to a shelter, what else can they not work together on that we don't know about?
Okay. And speaking of which, the city responded to this criticism. We'll get to that, among other things, when we come back. And of course, we'll get an update on the situation with COVID and with vaccinations for COVID when we come back as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup right now on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Andy Maher from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. We played that piece of tape from Dino DiOrio complaining about the city manager a moment ago not following through on something that they had agreed upon, allegedly. The city of Charlotte responded yesterday with a statement which read in part, quote, like many stakeholders, the city of Charlotte was given little notice of the county's abatement order. And it goes on to say that they had committed to supporting the county when asked to provide transportation and to provide buses to help in that effort. But they were told later by the county, according to the city statement, that they no longer needed the city's support for transportation. Has anyone been able to confirm either side of this story?
So, I was just going to say, you know, Mike, you played the clip from the county manager earlier, and you won't have any kind of audio or thing to report from Marcus Jones, the city manager, because Marcus Jones does not talk. He does not communicate to the community, to the media. So you're kind of left with that vague statement from the city and try and kind of like split hairs and figure out what they're talking about. And, you know, and I think the idea that the city is saying, well, we were given little time. I mean, I think that's true, but this isn't particularly difficult. I mean, this is not D-Day they're trying to pull off. And to kind of pass this off as saying, you know, oh, we only had 48 hours, do better.
The fact that Marcus Jones does not talk to the media was something we were alerted to by Nick Oxner, who used to work in the Newport News, Norfolk area, where Marcus also worked, and he said he didn't talk there. But he's been on this program many times.
You are a rare exception.
That's because I'm a nice guy.
I'll take your word for it because I've never met him, despite having covered him for much of the last decade at this point as a journalist. But look, I say that, but it is underscores a bigger issue with transparency, both around this situation and if we can just take a second to continue to harp on the lack of transparency from the city as a whole. It's a problem. But you mentioned my colleague David Hodges covering the story earlier. He tweeted out sometime this week, wow, we can't get any answers from anybody about anything related to Tent City. He tweeted that Wednesday, and then, you know, on Thursday we've got public officials pointing fingers at each other and we can't get answers. And this is what happens when the county's hardly better than the city at being transparent, except for when it suits them. And so this is what happens, though. You get this level of dysfunction when you have government agencies unwilling to provide details or any information to the public.
So this is happening. This evacuation of Tent City is happening at 5 o'clock this afternoon in contradiction to an order or a recommendation by the CDC. They have said that no tent cities anywhere in the country should be shut down during this pandemic. Shelters have to spread out beds to comply with social distancing, and many of those living in tents at this Tent City and in tent cities around the country feel safer because they can socially distance themselves from others. Like this resident who identified himself as Isaiah, he is suspicious of conditions in shelters during the pandemic.
I think that's the most dangerous place you can go. For some fact, you got hundreds of people going inside the shelter trying to get a bed, and you're all bunched up together, like you don't know who's sick in there. You know, that's why I'd rather have a hotel where I know I can be sanitized and quarantined alone by myself.
So are we trading one health hazard for another, rats and garbage for COVID-19?
It's worth noting that most of the Tent City residents are going to a hotel, and we don't know the specific details because, again, they won't tell us anything about the hotel. And I suspect give it a couple weeks and we'll start getting calls about people who have problems with the hotel and those arrangements. It's just a hunch. Okay. I don't know. I would say a hotel is different than a shelter, and hopefully is enough to have, you know, ensure adequate social distancing and safe living quarters.
Well, let's move on to some good news. The good news is actually on the COVID front for once, and that is the fact that the number of cases and the number of hospitalizations appears to be on the decline. This is a national phenomenon, but it's also happening here, even as the number of variants of COVID, which may be more virulent and more easily contagious, are on the rise. But the waiting list for vaccinations is also growing. Mecklenburg County Public Health reports about 7,000 people are on the waiting list. The county says they're not certain of the exact number. Is that just the list for those waiting for the shot from the county, or does it also include people on waiting lists from Novant and Atrium? Does anybody know the answer to that? Because I can't find an answer to that.
You're striking out, Mike, on the questions okay. You would think government could explain to us, but they won't.
Okay. Annie, County Medical Director Meg Sullivan. Dr. Meg Sullivan says the majority of people on the waiting list, at the county at least, are educators. They will be eligible for shots beginning on February 24th. That's next Wednesday. Schools started this past Monday. The federal government has said that vaccinating teachers is not a prerequisite for reopening schools, but teachers obviously are still worried about this. How quickly, after next Wednesday, might teachers be able to get this vaccine?
It's a great question. You know, there's still a lot of demand and not as much supply as demand on that front. I know that teachers who, I heard that the first day that they were eligible to sign up for the February 24th date, the website crashed, which to them was kind of like, what else to expect this year for teachers has been a lot of technical difficulties that they've had to work through and been resilient through. So it's a good question. I don't exactly know what that looks like, but I think it could be a while for a lot of people to get all of the shots that they need.
Well, the Observer reported that older CMS teachers, 65 and up, they got priority at last weekend's Spectrum Center vaccination site. Do we have any idea of how many of those 65 plus teachers took part in that?
You know, they did put out numbers. I am not recalling them right off the top of my head. And I believe the reason they got priority is that they'll be working in person and they're in the group one and two eligibility because of their age.
Yeah. Well, group one and two, I'm glad you brought that up because county leaders are strongly encouraging, their words, anyone from groups one and two, which include healthcare workers, residents and long-term staff at long-term care facilities and anybody over 65 who have not yet been vaccinated to reach out to the county for those shots. Clear this up if you can, somebody. If you're on a waiting list at the county or on a waiting list at Novant or Atrium, should you reach out or do you just wait?
I don't think it hurts to be proactive. What we do know is that at the end of basically each day that they have vaccination clinics, both here in Charlotte and any other vaccination clinic across the state, they have leftovers, right? And they have people who cancel appointments and things happen. And so we've heard just anecdotally stories where people are calling and checking on cancellations or openings or extra doses at the last minute. And sometimes it results in people getting a shot. So it doesn't hurt to be proactive like that.
Is there a central location where people can call or go online and sign up for any of these vaccination situations, whether it's through the county or Atrium or Novant? And the question I would have about that is, if there's not one, why isn't there one? We've had a year now to figure this out.
Well, Mike, no, there's a central location for each provider. So no, which isn't central. And, you know, I think what has happened initially in the state's response, they pushed, because the state is responsible for allocating these doses of vaccine. So they pushed vaccine to the hospitals, right? And then they sent to county health departments and they said, we want to give basically a proportionally equal number of doses to each county across the state. And we're going to try to get it spread out. Well, what that resulted in is some people doing it really well and getting a lot of doses out quickly. And it resulted in other places not doing it that well and taking a long time and doses sitting around unused. And what we've seen now is the state has prioritized its distribution to people that can get it out quickly. But what that means is it's going a lot of different places still. And so it's really hard to centralize this. I mean, the state can barely keep track. Its own computer system has had problems for keeping track of the vaccine. Yeah. So it's a moving target, but it has gotten better and more expedient and efficient over the last few weeks.
Glenn.
One thing the county announced this week is that they're inviting community organizations to volunteer to host vaccination clinics. The idea being that at those levels, they can kind of cut through some of the red tape, waiting lists, things like that, having to have an appointment, unlike the mass vaccination events or even or even going to a healthcare company, these community events, which up to now have primarily been at churches, people are just allowed to show up and get vaccinated. And so they're apparently looking to expand that effort beyond churches, and they're now inviting community organizations to volunteer to host vaccination events, and particularly in underserved communities.
Did you want to add to that, Steve?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think those community events are interesting. I went to one a couple weekends ago with the Hindu Center in East Charlotte, and yeah, the county has made them a priority to reach underserved people. And part of what they do is they deliberately don't talk about them. I mean, it's kind of a word of mouth where they, you know, that they're in contact with community leaders, and those leaders then tell people they know, and they kind of try and deliberately keep it very quiet, because they know if they put out an all points news release, they will be overwhelmed. I mean, people will just stampede to the sites, and the people who they want to get the vaccine may get pushed to the back of the line.
If you rely on community leaders to tell people they know, are the people they know going to be in a certain socioeconomic niche?
I don't believe that has happened based on my limited observation so far. The people who I've seen going to these clinics, the people I know who've gone, they have not been from a certain socioeconomic niche. They've been community people who, granted, did hear about it through word of mouth, but they were not handpicked by any means.
Good to know. Of course, the series of serious winter storms that has been plaguing the country is slowing down vaccine delivery, just as the Biden administration is trying to speed things up. This state, North Carolina, has been notified by the federal government that shipments, both first and second doses, have been impacted. No Moderna vaccines were shipped this week, and only a limited number of Pfizer vaccines were shipped. Do we have any idea how long this delay may be impacting this? Okay. North Carolina also announced this week that it is shifting its vaccine distribution guidance to dissuade people from coming here from out of state to get vaccinated. They say it is now permissible to, quote, not offer vaccine to temporary travelers who do not reside, work, or spend significant time in North Carolina. How big a problem has this been up to now? There are people who live here who can't get this thing.
Not a non-problem, and that's because, Mike, it's important to remember the federal government pays for every dose of COVID vaccine. And so under the federal guidelines, initially, you had to agree to not put in any residency-based restrictions. And in our area, it's been working both ways, right? People going to South Carolina to get the vaccine, up in the mountains, people going over to Tennessee, and of course, people coming the other way, too. It really got highlighted when the former governor of Virginia went down to North Carolina, to the Outer Banks, to get his vaccine down from Virginia Beach. And he said, boy, this is so great because Virginia can't get its stuff together. And so look how great North Carolina is. It's only been, I'm using a round number here, but about 3% of vaccines have gone to people from out of state.
It's greater than 27,000. That's the number that I saw.
Yes, which when you look at the, you know, million plus vaccines mm-hmm. we've given out, 3% is 3%, right? But it's enough for the Cooper administration to say, how can we cut down on this?
So that number's 27,000. 26,000 is a whole different number, Annie Ma. That's the number of students at CMS who returned to pre-K through 8th grade this week for 2 days, I believe, of in-classroom instruction for the first time since December. More than a few kids were excited at the prospect of going back to school.
Today was great. It was exciting.
I had a good day at school.
I was just so excited. I got my clothes on in like 30 seconds.
Thanks to WBTV for that audio, but that did not mean parents weren't still at least a little concerned. Here's what Joseph Bowman told WSOC as he dropped off his first and second graders at Lawrence Orr Elementary.
It's a little concerning, obviously, but you know, we really care about their education, so it's, you know, it's really important that they get some in-class learning, because I feel like the kids are just behind this year.
So, Annie, how did it go?
You know, this week is a little bit of don't know the best way to put it. It's not as unprecedented even as before, because elementary schools and all the other student groups who came back this week were back in the fall. The real test of the logistical side will be next Monday when traditional middle schools and high schools start coming back through their rotations.
And why will that be more difficult?
Well, I don't know if it'll be more difficult. It'll just be different in the sense that in the fall, we elementary schools, I believe, had 6 weeks of in-person learning and kind of worked through whatever kinks came up. The middle schools and high schools haven't had kids come in through their rotations, which are structured a little differently. And there are stricter operating guidelines from the state level for those higher grades, including limiting the number of kids on buses, greater requirements for social distancing, things like that, that they'll have to contend with.
Prior to the reopening, there were a lot of concerns about adequate safety precautions being taken, like making sure all the bathrooms have soap and hand towels, making sure that the HVA systems had been revamped or adjusted to allow for greater ventilation. And that's very difficult to do for some of these older schools. Did it appear that many or most or all of these precautions were successfully taken?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of work done in terms of stocking up, sanitation. They've really put up, when I was touring schools in the fall, they had signs up about social distancing, masking, all of that. The biggest concern that I've heard from educators, though, is on the ventilation front, right? When we look at all the precautions that come from the CDC, that's one of the biggest things that people talk about, is bringing in clean air so you don't concentrate virus particles in the air. And CMS has done a lot of work on it, but I think they've described a lot of that work as in process and not completed, which can be really concerning if you're heading back into those buildings.
Parents still have the option to keep their kids online only, I think, through the end of this year. Do we know how many parents have selected that option? Because there's also a drive to get kids back to the classroom by parents.
I believe the number, the last time I checked in January, it was around 55,000, and the district has roughly 140,000 kids, so close to like the 35-40% range.
When we come back from the break, there's still more to talk about with regard to education, because there's a move in Raleigh to make kids go back, or to make systems open immediately, all of the schools, and bring everybody back into the classroom. The governor has some problems with that particular piece of legislation. We'll talk about that. And then the big snafu with the census, which we've been talking about on and off for months. The pandemic caused the census to be very difficult to conduct for whatever reason. And there were some shenanigans at the Trump level as well. We'll talk about the local impact of that. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, which explains the presence of Steve Harrison from WFAE News and Glenn Birkins from QCD Metro, Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner from WBTV. Nick, the legislature sent Governor Cooper a bill requiring the state's K-12 public school districts to offer in-person learning and to address alternative work assignments for teachers at high risk for COVID-19. They have enough votes, I'm told, to override any gubernatorial veto. The governor has said the bill fell short of his expectations. In what way, and given the fact that his veto will fall on deaf ears, will he veto it?
Well, it is highly unlikely that, I don't think it's likely that we'll see a veto, and we'll get back to why in a second. But to answer your other questions, Governor Cooper has said that this bill didn't meet DHHS guidelines, and basically has said he didn't think that the bill included enough parameters for social distancing and COVID protocols. That being said, he hasn't said he would veto it. He said he was going to review it and wasn't sure that he would sign it. Keep in mind, a bill can become law without a governor's signature after 10 days. He put out the statement, kind of his first statement, casting doubt on this, and then the vote in the House to pass a final version of this bill increased in number and got additional Democrats after that. If something's veto-proof in North Carolina these days, it means that there's a bipartisan supermajority of of lawmakers supporting it. There is that for this bill. So I think it is indicative that Cooper is saying, I have problems with this, but it looks like he's not going to veto it. What you're seeing now, though, is Republicans in North Carolina trying to pressure the governor to actually sign it. So we are back to our game of political chicken in North Carolina.
Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, like Nick said, I mean, there are more than enough votes to override any veto. And some of the Democrats, the Democratic kind of House members who voted for it, I mean, they're kind of across the spectrum. I mean, there's Greg Meyer from Orange County, which is, you know, a super liberal place, a lot of cautious parents. He voted with the bill. I think there was a House member from Wake County. So I think the governor is looking at the Democratic support and realizing, like Nick said, it's not going to, you know, turn. And just saying, and I think this will be interesting too, because we've just had an election. The next election isn't until 2022, but I think Republicans feel that for the first time in a long time, they have an issue that might allow them to kind of roll back some of the gains Democrats have made in suburban areas. It's possible everyone forgets about this. Life goes back to normal very quickly. But I have a feeling that in 2022, in places like Mecklenburg County, this could be a big issue. Because every Mecklenburg Democrat voted against the bill.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting, too, that the bill differentiates between traditional public schools like Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools and charter schools, which have been a policy issue that's been pretty popular among Republicans here in North Carolina. And that's caused some friction with school districts and teachers organizers, too, that, like, why are you differentiating between these two types of publicly funded schools? And it kind of has become a sticking point in this bill.
And there's also a bill winding its way through the General Assembly that would require all school districts in the state to offer summer school to help offset pandemic learning loss. There appears to be bipartisan support for this. In Raleigh, it actually mandates 6 weeks of summer classes for K-12 students who have fallen behind. Is there funding attached? How do you determine who has fallen behind? And although it may be mandatory for the schools, is it mandatory for students and parents?
Yeah. So House Speaker Tim Moore said that he believes there that this won't be an unfunded mandate. There will be some money from COVID relief and things that and funds from a summer reading camp. And the program would be mandatory for school districts to offer, but optional for students and teachers. I'm not quite sure how they would identify the students of greatest need, but there is a provision that they would be prioritized for access to the program.
Okay. Every 10 years, the United States constitutionally must take a census. The 2020 census faced significant hurdles because of the pandemic and some goings on at the Trump administration involving extending the time and then cutting the time and then extending the time and cutting the time needed to take the census during a pandemic. Lack of available census data, though, may cause a delay in this fall's election here in Charlotte for mayor and for city council. Here's Republican City Councilman Ed Driggs.
Trying to achieve a regular election timeline this year when we're not going to have the census data until the end of September is essentially an impossibility.
And it's an impossibility, as I understand it, Steve, because they have to redraw the districts based on the census. They usually do that in the next month or two so that candidates can declare in the right district their candidacy. And if they're going to do that in September, there's no way you can have a November election. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Usually, if everything was working according to plan, we would start drawing new maps now and they would be finalized maybe around June. And then candidate filing would open in late July. But like you said, when the census is not going to even put out the data until the end of September, it just throws the whole process out of whack. And if you move forward, the city feels like basically they will get sued and lose.
What if you don't redraw the districts? What if you just let people run in their current districts, redraw them when possible, and then hold the next election and use those new districts? Nick?
See Steve's comment about getting sued and losing.
Okay.
There's an argument to make it's not constitutional.
Obviously, the district candidates have to know what district they're running in. But what about the at-large candidates? What about the mayor's race? That's all citywide. Why can't we do those people and come back and do the other district races later?
Yeah, this came up at Monday's council committee meeting. Like you said, it's a very good point. And I think the city attorney just felt like at the time there was no mechanism to split the race, either by state law or by city charter. And so Patrick Baker, the city attorney, really essentially made a strong recommendation that they push this back. And I think that vote could come as early as Monday. And again, and this will, CMS is going to have to go through this as well. They don't have permission yet. The city on its own can delay its election thanks to a 30-year-old state law that applies to municipalities. But the law, you know, CMS is not a municipality. So CMS has said they're going to be asking the state so they can push this back if they need to.
So what are they thinking about doing now? They're thinking, I understand it, about delaying this fall's election. So that would mean extending city council terms for a whole other year. Is that legal?
Yes. And then, like, okay. I said, there was you go back to 1990, the 1990 census, when there were problems with that census and there was concern about getting the maps done, the legislature passed a law that said the city could do this. You would have the election, the primary in March, the general election in November, and then they would be back on the ballot again in 2023 to try and get back on a normal cycle.
So we'd skip this year, they'd run for 1 year terms, and then we'd go back onto a normal cycle. It seems to me that if you delay this election, you wouldn't want to do an election for just a referendum on the transit plan, which was supposed to be on the bill, on the ballot in November. So does this give them an extra year to figure out what they're going to do? Because there's a lot of wrenches being thrown into the transit plan right now.
Yeah, I think this is actually if you're a transit backer, I think this is a silver lining in this whole mess, because, you know, if you're asking people to approve a penny sales tax in November, even under the best case scenario in the pandemic, like a pandemic recovery, people are still going to be hurting. Businesses won't be back fully. So if you can push this back until 2022, you have this chance for a recovery, for people to feel better, have more money. So I think for the pro-transit side, this is a good thing.
A part of the transit plan, in fact, what used to be the focal point, is the Silver Line, the Lynx Line from Matthews through uptown to the airport out to Belmont in Gaston County. But now a new alignment has been unveiled that would take it not only into downtown Belmont, but out to Belmont Abbey College, which is another mile away on the western end, and to the towns of Stallings and Indian Trail in Union County on the east end. When and why did this come about?
I mean, this has been the kind of dream for CATS for many years, to have a truly regional transit system. Mm-hmm. That it's not just Mecklenburg County. There's so many people who come to work in Charlotte from other counties, and wouldn't it be great if there was transit, rail transit to help them? We've got bus service, express bus service that goes in other counties. And also, wouldn't it be great if the outlying counties help pay for this? I mean, that's a big thing too, to have like a regional tax to raise more money. But again, those discussions, that's still so early in terms of getting a Gaston County or Union County to really pay big money for this.
I guess we start watching for the Blue Line extension to Fort Mill and Rock Hill in the future for regional buy-in purposes. It isn't often that we have actual audio of the moment that a politician gets into trouble, but in the case of Senator Richard Burr, we do.
Mr. Burr. Mr. Burr. Guilty.
That was his vote to convict former President Donald Trump in his Senate impeachment trial for inciting the riot at the Capitol. That vote incited the state GOP. They censured Burr. What does that mean, Steve or Nick?
Well, it means they're really angry with him. Here's why. It functionally means nothing, because we already know Richard Burr is retiring in 2 years. He's not running for another term when he's up in 2022. He said that. He told me that before he was reelected to his last term, so this isn't a surprise. In the Orange County Republican Party voted this week to ban him from their building, and he's not allowed at any Orange County Republican Party events. I think, though, this has actually stirred a discussion amongst some North Carolina Republicans about, did we really need to do that? I've seen that from some party activists over the last week. And so that's what that means.
Well, Michael Whatley, who's the chair of the state Republican Party, thinks they really need to do that. He spoke about this with Spectrum News.
I've had over 500, 600, 700 emails in the last couple of days, that have come into me. I've talked with hundreds of party leaders and activists all across the state. And to a person, they're very upset with the vote. And I think that this is an opportunity for the party to just make it clear that it's disappointed.
He said the vote serves as a symbolic gesture of the party's opposition to Burr's vote. How unusual is it for a state party to disagree so much with a vote in the Senate that
especially,
they feel it's necessary?
Especially with a senator like Richard Burr, who's been in Washington representing North Carolina one way or the other for the last 2.5 decades, right, 25 years, and is generally beloved by members of the Republican Party in North Carolina, right? He's been here a long time. And so, it's unusual in the wider context, but not unusual when you see what's playing out in other states where senators or members of the House voted to impeach or convict Donald Trump as well.
Well, seven Republican
Mike,
senators.
I was just going to say one thing, with the state party. Michael Whatley's been chair, I think, for 18 months. They did not do a censure vote. When Robin Hayes pleaded guilty, when David Lewis pleaded guilty. So, that's just interesting fun fact.
Seven Senate Republicans voted to convict Donald Trump. Many of them are in trouble with their state political parties. A few have been censured. Richard Burr said he did not take that vote lightly. He believed it was necessary because of what the former president, quote, did and did not do. President Trump violated, he said, his oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Which begs the question, if that's real, and it appears on most of the factors, including the fact that Mitch McConnell said Donald Trump was clearly guilty of this, where is the Republican Party at this point? Is it simply a cult?
I think that's still a place for ideas, but I think this week and people who have differing ideas, but I think the censuring post vote here shows or raises legitimate questions about how welcome those differing ideas are inside that party. But I think that's a debate that's going on inside the Republican Party at this point too.
It's harming their ability to be a big tent party, it seems to me. After what you describe as months of investigations by WBTV of CMPD's crime reduction units, Nick, your station reported this week, or actually you reported this week, that data shows a disproportionate number of people stopped, searched, and arrested by police are Black and Hispanic. How large is the disparity?
Yeah, so we looked at these crime reduction units in the Metro and Westover divisions. They're these specialized units that don't respond to calls. They just patrol high crime areas. In the Metro division, 98% of people arrested by the Metro CRU in a 12-month period were Black, not Black or Hispanic, Black. And in the Westover division, 92% of people arrested by this unit. When we look at traffic stops for these two units combined, 90% of people they were stopping, and separately, 90% of people they were searching were Black or Hispanic. CMPD says this is because they're focused on high crime areas within their divisions, which tend to be minority neighborhoods.
Wow. Okay. Charlotte's DeRuyter Station Post Office got a new name this week, the Julius Chambers Civil Rights Memorial Post Office. Glenn, I have 30 seconds. Remind us of who Julius Chambers was, because he was an important dude.
He absolutely was. He was a noted civil rights attorney here in Charlotte, played a major role in a lot of important civil rights cases, including desegregating our schools.
Yeah, he was the one that went to the Supreme Court with the Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education, which led the system to be desegregated. And we became the poster child for successful desegregated schools in the country until it all changed. So congratulations to Julius Chambers for his name going up on the post office. That's the last word goes to Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Andy Maul was here from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Wendy Herkey is the executive producer. The senior producer is Aaron Kiever. Chris Miller is the producer. Our assistant producer is Jesse Steinmetz. Our production assistant is Jennifer Warsham. And our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.